This is a production of Cornell University.
William Lee is a professor of computer science at Cornell's College of Engineering, where she's been a member of the faculty since 1997. She has an AB in mathematics and computer science from Cornell, and an MS and a PhD degree in computer science from Harvard. Lillian is the winner of a number of awards and honors, including the Alfred P. Sloan Research Fellowship, and from Cornell, the Stephen and Marilyn Miles Excellence in Teaching Award, the James and Marion Tien Excellence in Teaching Award, the Provost Award for Distinguished Scholarship, and the Kendall S. Carpenter Memorial Advising Award. Lillian's research involves natural language processing, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, and it has received mentions in such places as the New York Times, NPR's All Things Considered, and NBC's The Today Show. But natural language processing and machine learning, what's that mean exactly? Well, we know that computers can fly airplanes, they can predict the paths of hurricanes, and they beat the best human chess players. But can they do something that even young children can do? That is, can they hold a natural sounding conversation? Well, we're about to find out. Lillian Lee, I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that. And where does that come from? Okay. How many under the age of 18 knew that? Or thereabouts. Anyway, can computers really understand what we said?
I'm going to stand here instead of behind the podium because there's only so much of me. So I hope that's okay with everybody. I know it's been a couple of hot days and it's after dinner. Therefore, we're going to aim this talk to be kind of more on the light entertainment side of things. Is that okay with you? Yes. So just to get people warmed up and feeling kind of relaxed, let me ask you a couple of questions. How many of you here are familiar with or can use some language other than English? Pretty good. How many of you took a class in a language other than English in college? Is that the same set of people? Good. And does anyone here read Russian? Darn! Okay, I'm still going to try to get away with a joke here, but I'll keep an eye on you guys. Okay, I first want to talk about the dream and the promise of computers that can understand what people say. Why is this man smiling? Well, that's Alan Turing. And 2012, this year, marks the 100th anniversary of his birth. Now, this is a man who is responsible for a great many things, who is really one of the geniuses of the 20th century. I'll highlight some of the things that it says here. He's widely recognized as the father of modern computer science, also the father of artificial intelligence, and as it says here, he had the mind that in a handful of papers over a tragically short lifetime shaped many of the hottest fields there are today. Now, among his accomplishments, and they were many, was the proposal of the so-called Turing test, although he didn't use that term. The Turing test posits that human intelligence can be demonstrated by natural language conversation. That is, as this little thing says here, he proposed that a machine can be termed intelligent if it can respond to queries, if it can hold a conversation in a way that is completely indistinguishable from the way a human being would speak. And I put in this little clip here, or picture here from Blade Runner. It's sort of like the setting where, if you've seen the movie, Harrison Ford is trying to figure out if Sean Young is a replicant, an android. So he talks to her and he tries to engage her in a conversation to test whether she's actually a human being or not. Okay. And Turing predicted that we'd be close to having built computers or systems that can understand and engage in the Turing test successfully in about 50 years, which is a little past us now. It's this idea of computers that can speak to us, of things we built that can have conversations with us, has a long history. We certainly see it a lot in science fiction. Many of you will be familiar with Data here from Star Trek The Next Generation. He's an android. He kind of looks like a person, except he's got that kind of greenish cast to him. But not all these machines have to look like human beings. So you may remember this, Knight Rider from the 80s. That was a car that talked to us. Or here, this is from Iron Man. What I'm pointing out here is not Robert Downey Jr., but the reflection is the output from the system Jarvis. It was kind of his butler. You know, it had this AI system that could talk to him, it could arrange his appointments and the like. Okay. And this, as Bud has sort of pointed out also, is one of the most famous interactions from sci-fi films of humans talking to computers. What we have here is Dave, and he's outside the spaceship, and he would like to come in the spaceship. So he says, "Open the pod bay doors, Hal." And Hal here is the Hal 9000. It's a computer. It doesn't have any arms or anything, but it's a system. It replies in that very polite way, "I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that." Okay. So that was science fiction. Science fiction has promised us and envisioned that computers can talk to us for quite a while. But going from science fiction to science and engineering, where are we today? So the field that's responsible for trying to create such systems goes by several names, including human language technologies. I prefer the term natural language processing, or NLP. The goal of this field, which I happen to be a participant in, is to create systems that can use human language as input and or as output. Okay, and that may mean speech, it may mean written language, it may mean documents on the web, things like that. So what are the kind of systems we're hoping to build? As you can see in this list here, you can imagine interfaces that allow us to talk instead of type. That would be speech-based interfaces. Information retrieval or question answering. Many of us are familiar with Google or other search engines like Bing. Those things bring up, when we type in a query, it brings up documents that contain the information we want. A question answering system would actually tell us the answer to the questions we want. Another application that would be great to have is automatic summarization. You guys may get a lot of email. It'd be great to get a free-form summary of what was in that email, what's the important stuff. It'd be great to have systems that can automatically create such things. Automatic summarization is that subfield. And automatic translation, something like Google Translate, if you're familiar with that. You know, someone's talking in French or, God forbid, Russian, and we would like to know what it is they said. Can we get computers to automatically do that translation for us? Okay. There are many other possibilities. So I think the applications are pretty compelling, and some of you have actually used some already yourselves. Personally, one reason I really like being in this field, besides the applications, is that it's really interdisciplinary. So I get to talk to a lot of really fun people who are also much smarter than I am. So as you can imagine, dealing with systems that are supposed to deal with natural language involves not only computer science, which is my home field, but also fields you might expect, like linguistics and psychology and communication, and, as we'll see, fields you might not necessarily expect at first, such as probability and statistics and information theory. So again, this is a field that just draws on a whole bunch of other areas of inquiry, so I just enjoy it a ton, as I hope to convey to you in this talk. Okay. In terms of applications, where are we now? In some sense, you might be like, the victory is won. We're already there. The singularity has happened. I don't know if you've heard that kind of talk before. But anyway, certainly you might have seen the ads. This is a little picture of Siri, which is actually in beta, for those of you who have played with it. Siri comes on the iPhone. As this ad proves, you can say to Siri, "I'm in the mood for Italian food in North Beach." And she's a she, will respond, "I found a number of Italian restaurants in North Beach," and give you the answer to your implied desires. Yay! Okay, so that's Siri. Another thing, I don't know if people knew about this, the IBM system Watson. This system, this is a state-of-the-art research system, Mondo computer, things like that. It plays Jeopardy, the TV show, game show Jeopardy, and it plays it so well that it in fact beat these two human champions. Okay, and before people interpret this result the wrong way, let me point out a couple of things. The system Watson, it did not have access to the internet at the time. Okay, it did not have the questions beforehand. People did not just encode every single fact in the world and put it on a disk and insert it in. Okay, for most intents and purposes, it was under the same conditions that the human beings were under, and it won. Okay, so now, I mean, that's question, well, it's not exactly question answering, it's answering questioning, but Jeopardy, yeah. Yes, this is the kind of talk I'm going to give. What happened to do? This is amazing. This thing learned the way people do, by reading a lot of documented text and stuff it could get off the web before the match. Okay, so that's just a spectacular success. So you might say, we're done. This is a picture, as you might recognize, of my host. He's saying, hey, I'm so happy these natural language technologies are here today and the talk is over, right? Sadly, that is not the case. We are not all there yet, okay? It may look, we have accomplished quite a few fantastic things, but you may also know that we haven't gotten everything just right. So here are some examples from my real life, okay? Here, this is supposed to be me, making up a grocery list, okay? And there's the old manual way to do it where you'd actually write the list down. I'll just throw this out for you because there are a lot of young people in the audience. Did you know that if you put your list in the order of the aisles in the grocery, that actually saves a lot of time? I've been told a lot of people don't know this, and I don't understand how you can live like that. So now you know. Okay, so there's the old manual way to write grocery lists, but I decided, well, let's try this voice dictation thing, you know, it'll save me some time and stuff like that. So I said, you know, I would like a bunch of grapes. Siri transcribed this, strangely, as, hey, bunch of grapes. I found this kind of baffling, and I do natural language processing for a living. At first I thought maybe Siri is kind of startled, like, hey, bunch of grapes. I didn't know you needed that, or something like that. But then I thought, you know, let's take this as optimistic. Maybe she's like really happy for me. Like, hey, bunch of grapes. You know? All the same, this is clearly some sort of transcription error. A little surprising. Here's another one. Some colleagues and I were trying to arrange a meeting with someone. So again, we said, let's try the iPhone. We're NLP people here. Siri, transcribe this. We can email you when you're back. Siri took the voice input, drum roll please, and transcribed the voice. We can email you when you're fat. Again, I have theories as to how this came up with that. Again, remember Siri is in beta, but this is just a warning to you, you know, just before, really be really careful before you hit, or now even these days, say the word send. Okay. Here's a mistake that Watson made. Remember the Jeopardy championship playing computer? Alex Trebek, if you know the Jeopardy situation, they give you the answer to a question and you have to come up with the question. Okay, Alex Trebek here said something about this US city's largest airport, and there was some other thing to the rest of the query. Watson responded, what is Toronto? Now, we human beings know, human beings, assuming we're all human here, know that no matter what that dot 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 stands for, this cannot be a correct answer. Why is that? Toronto's not in the US. How did Watson get that wrong? Well, there's speculation and some explanations from the engineers, but nonetheless, it got this wrong. Okay, which is sort of seems surprising that the thing can be playing at championship levels and still make what is clearly a very basic error. So this is where we're at. We're not all there yet. These things can do astounding things, but they can also be mind-bogglingly stupid. All right, which in some sense you could argue is a sign of intelligence, but that's another thing. Now's the part where I trip on the stage, right? All right, so why is understanding language so hard? Why, with all these processors and people working on this problem, do we still not have it down? So let me try to introduce to you some of the problems that occur just through some kind of hopefully fun examples. Suppose you're talking to a system and you ask it to list all flights on Tuesday. You imagine you're trying to travel somewhere. Okay. Now I'm sure you all have a meaning in your head that you think this sentence represents, right? List all flights on Tuesday, nothing tricky going on here. But it turns out there are at least two interpretations of this sentence. The first thing here demonstrates what you probably have all assumed that meant. That is, if you take the phrase on Tuesday, that relates to, that modifies the word flights, meaning list all the flights that are leaving on Tuesday. But there's another interpretation lurking here, as represented by the second thing here. Maybe the words on Tuesday modify the word list. In which case that says, hey computer, wait till Tuesday, then tell me about all the flights. Okay, and that's probably not what you want, because you're certainly not going to wait on the phone until Tuesday. Right? Okay, so, sorry. Okay. So, this kind of ambiguity, I mean, and this is a very serious error to make. How come we as people know that this is the right interpretation? Okay, when both of these interpretations are actually pretty close, if you kind of think about the structure of these things. So, that's supposed to be one example of why language is hard. You may have said, oh, that example's a little contrived, there's no real ambiguity. I would just make sure that the phrase flights on Tuesday or flights on Wednesday always was encoded as the thing that human beings are expecting. But this, I would claim, is a truly ambiguous sentence or phrase. Retrieve all the local patient files, you might order. Okay. In which case, maybe, now what is that word local modifying? It could be the patients that are local, or it could be the files that are local. Okay. So I would argue that that's a true ambiguity and that this is a perfectly natural thing to say. So it's not that these ambiguities just come from contrived sentences. All right. That being said, I have a favorite contrived sentence. Okay. I saw her duck with a telescope. All right. This has a lot of possible meanings, some of them more likely than others. I hear some giggles here. Play along with me. Okay. What does this sentence mean? Well, it could mean a lot of things. If you look at the word duck, okay, it could mean duck, like I'm ducking because people are throwing potatoes at me for some reason. Okay. Or the word duck could mean the animal, the duck. Okay. In which case, in either case, you have to ask, what, who has the telescope? It could be, I'm holding the telescope and I'm ducking. It could be, I'm seeing with the telescope. It could be, the telescope is under the wing of the duck. Okay. All these things are possibilities. How many are we at? Five or six possibilities already? Anyone see anything else this sentence could mean? Yeah, there's some hands, okay. Let me now attack a single word, saw. You're all thinking that means like this, with your eyes, okay? But there's a more grisly reading here. Not an obvious reading, but possible. Kind of a grim scenario, okay. But and here's one that someone surprised me with at a talk some years ago. Imagine the zombie apocalypse has happened, and we're now in a barter economy. And you're playing poker, okay? So this person bets the duck, and you see that duck with a telescope. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven words. Seven simple little words, and this sentence could mean a bazillion things. So what I'm trying to get, of course, again, this is a Baroque example, but the idea is that language is rife with ambiguity. That's one of the beauties of language, right? In some sense, you can say very complex notions with very short utterances, but it makes language hard for computers to understand. If every sentence meant just one and only one thing, you'd just take that one and one thing and store it on the computer and you'd be all done. Okay? So ambiguity is one of the big problems that makes understanding natural language hard for computers. It actually makes it hard for people too, right? Sometimes people say things and we didn't quite get what they meant. All right, these are all sentences in isolation. God help us when two people start talking. Okay, this is an example due to Ralph Grishman in 1986, it's artificial. you imagine that this person here, let's call her Trillian, is talking to this little robot here, let's call him Marvin, and she's in a hurry, she wants to get somewhere. So she says to Marvin, do you know when the train to Boston leaves? And Marvin replies, quite reasonably, yes. He's got a brain the size of a planet. Yes, he knows when the next train to Boston leaves. Trillian's a little distressed by this response, but she figures she hasn't made herself clear. She says, I want to know when the train to Boston leaves. Marvin takes this sentence and goes, I understand. This is a very frustrating conversation. In fact, you would say this conversation has failed. Yes? Yes? Okay. And if you're going to build systems that respond this way, you might well do well to put them behind bulletproof glass. Right? People get very, very upset when they're not understood. Okay, so notice that Marvin here has technically understood the literal meaning of each of Trillian's sentences, right? But he hasn't understood something deeper, which is what she meant to say and what she meant for him to do. Okay, so understanding language is really hard, not just because understanding the structure of language is hard, right? But it also involves having to understand things about the world, like has the zombie apocalypse happened, and things about what human beings want, which as we all know is a toughie, right? So when robots say things like, I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that, maybe they have ill intent, but those of us who do natural language processing are tempted to respond, I'm afraid you might be right. Okay, so how can we meet these challenges? We do know that these challenges have been met, right? Because Siri does do a decent job sometimes. Watson did beat poor Ken, whatever his name was, Jefferson or whatever, but at the top Jeopardy champion. What have we scientists and engineers done to at least make some progress on these hard problems? So what I'd like to do is take you through a little brief history of what we've been up to in the last 50 years or so. Well, not me personally, but, you know. So in the 1940s and 50s, a kind of radical proposition was made. This is Claude Shannon in 1948. He proposed thinking about language in a probabilistic fashion, which sounds kind of weird. We didn't talk really about probabilities in the last 5 minutes or so. We have here, he makes a strong and sort of strange assertion. The fundamental problem of communication is that of reproducing at one point, either exactly or approximately, a message selected at another point. If you were Trillian in that last Train to Boston example, you would not agree, probably, that this was the point of your communication. In fact, Claude Shannon goes on to say, controversially, the semantic aspects of communication, i.e. what things actually mean, are irrelevant to the engineering problem. Which is really, yeah, I see some people flinching, right? How can this be? What she meant, Trillian meant, was the whole point of the conversation. Finally, in the same passage, this one famous passage, Shannon says, the significant aspect of communication is that the actual message is one selected from a set of possible messages. He's saying it just matters what's the probability of a given message, or if you like, what are the messages that weren't picked. Okay. This sounds baffling. What I'm talking to you right now, are any of you reproducing at your point what I just said? Well, some people are typing, but you know what I mean. Right? How could you possibly think something like this? Well, here's one clue. Shannon was working for the telephone company, back in the days when there was the telephone company. All you young people, just imagine. So what problem was he considering? He is considering the problem of you've got one person at one end of the line, and you want to make sure that the same message ends up at the other point end of the line. In which case, this idea of reproducing of the message starts to make more sense. Maybe not with respect to human beings, but you can see that's one aspect of communication, making sure the message got across, to make a metaphor of it. Okay. Where else does this idea of statistics having to do with language come up with? Well, Shannon, among other things, not only did he deal with the theory of communication, but at the same time, again, one of the geniuses of the past century, he was also working on the problem of cryptography. Someone else who thought about cryptography or code breaking was Alan Turing. Remember Alan Turing? Yes. Okay. During World War II, he and his team helped break the German Enigma code, which was a practical application of using statistics in language. For instance, it happened to help us win World War II. Okay. So major breakthrough here. And cryptography, really, the kind of notion we have of decoding is looking for patterns in languages and seeing how they correlate with other languages, right? So you start kind of seeing how you might start trying to see language in a sort of statistical fashion, looking at patterns and numbers and the data. Okay, I circled this here. This is the Enigma machine. The way the Enigma code was created is the Germans would type in the German and then the letters would get transcribed into other letters. Just so you know, this summer only, Jay Walker? The Priceline guy, Cornell alum, he's temporarily donated parts of his collection to Cornell. And so you can view it at the Kroc Library, which is that underground thing at Olin Library. One of the things he has there for you history buffs is an original Enigma machine. So you can take a look at it. I recommend it. It's a pretty cool collection. It has, what else it has? It has an original Sputnik and. Oh, pieces of Vanguard satellite. It has some of Rorschach's original. I mean, don't say that right. The Rorschach's original ink blots. It's pretty cool. Thanks to Jay Walker. Thanks, alums. All right. Anyway, so this idea of encryption. Okay. And thinking about decoding languages. How does this apply to natural languages? Well, here's kind of a wacky idea. We could think about this in the setting of machine translation, right? I talked about applications of automatic translation to be built. So here we have a Russian speaker saying something in Russian. If we apply the decoding scenario to this, we might imagine, just bear with me, the following. Okay. That although this person spoke this Russian phrase or sentence or whatever it is, he's actually thinking in English. And what happens is that he's actually thinking in English, but something happens. Many a slip between cup and lip. There's some sort of encryption process that happens in his head after he thinks in English, the one true language, right? It accidentally, after going through this encryption process, comes out as Russian. Stunned silence. This is absurd. Why are you all letting me talk this way, right? This, as a model of language, is just stupendously stupid. Yes? Yes? Please? Okay. However, there's a famous saying that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. This, although spectacularly wrong, is a spectacularly useful model. And in fact, this model is what is at the core of Google Translate and the top state-of-the-art machine translation systems now. It allows us to think this way, okay, so now here's how I'm going to introduce how do probabilities come into it. Here we have, again, the corruption process, the original message, and then the garbled Russian that comes out. What we can imagine as statisticians now is to say, well, I can think about modeling this process in two steps. I can look for what's the probability of generating this original message? What's the probability someone would think the thought, I can see Alaska from my house? And we could estimate this by looking at lots of data. Look at what people say. Do they tend to say things like, I can see Alaska from my house or not? Okay. There's some opinions in the front row. All right. Secondly, so that's our first probability, which we can get from data. We can also think about modeling this encryption process as what's the probability of making this encryption given that original message? And that we could hope to learn from the statistics of looking at human beings doing translations and seeing, well, how many times do they translate da as yes, or that's the limit of my Russian, but you get the idea. Okay. So the idea is, once we have this idea, we can break this problem of decryption into modeling these two separate probabilities, learning those probabilities, and then going to town. Okay. So that's how the probabilistic ideas kind of come into it. And as I said before, this is the basis for the top-of-the-line machine translation system, research machine translations out there, and in fact, Google Translate as well, although there's some hand-coded stuff in there, too. It's Siri. another place, I just want to show that this idea of the probabilities of language has wide application. So let me move to another setting of speech recognition, okay? This is a famous example. If you look at the two sentences, it's hard to recognize speech, and it's hard to recognize speech. What order did I say those in? They sound about the same, right? So if you give this to a speech recognizer, that particular signal, it has to decide which sentence I said. How might it do it, given that the acoustics seem so similar? Well, we just had this idea of looking at the probability of messages. So we could back off to look at which of these two sentences has the higher likelihood, right? Is it more likely for people to say it's hard to recognize speech, or is it more likely for them to talk about trashing nice sandy beaches somewhere, okay? And actually, so that's the idea, and that's how many modern speech recognizers work. They try to look at, again, that same decoupling that we saw on the previous slide, look at what's the probability of a given thing being said, and then what's the probability of that thing being said in this way. For those of you keeping track at home, I have a confession to make. I checked this out on the web. It actually turns out this example is so famous that this occurs more times in the web. I blame the music industry. But anyway, but that's laugh about recognized speeches. So now you know that. Okay, so thus I tried there to introduce the idea of probabilistic models of language and how they might help. And that, I said those were introduced in the 1940s and 1950s. So you might say, well, where was Siri in 1960 when I needed her? Okay, well, something happened along the way. This guy called Noam Chomsky came along. Some of you may have heard of him. Very, very influential linguist, among other things. In 1957, he proposed the following thought experiment. He said, consider the following two sentences. Sentences considered loosely here. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. And now take B. Furiously sleep ideas green colorless. None of those sentences mean a damn thing, right? In fact, even none of these consecutive pairs of words make any sense. How can something be colorless and green? How can an idea be green? How can ideas sleep, and how can anything sleep furiously? So by God, I have tried. Okay. A little insight to my personal life there. Right, so Chomsky said, you consider these two things. If you look at the entire history of English up to 1957, no one had ever said either of these things before. Right? I promise. However, if that's the case, then if you took any statistical model that tried to learn probabilities from prior data, if neither of those things have occurred before, then that model has to say both of them are impossible. Both of them get zero probability. Now, the problem with that is that you probably do feel there's a difference between A and B. Right? A is at least grammatical. B is just word salad. Okay? So although your statistical model, whatever you came up with, claims Chomsky, would have said these are equally likely, us human beings know for a fact that that is more likely than that. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes.
With this anecdote, Chomsky killed my field. Okay? It wasn't mine at the time. But this basically said, he was saying statistical methods cannot work. All right. And again, this one is so famous as to also have become false. Go ahead and Google that one versus that one. You know how it is. So this one shows up a lot more than this. The web proves that the one is more likely than the other. But the point that Chomsky was making, still one sees what it is. Okay. So given this, people said, oh my gosh, he's right. He is a genius. A lot of geniuses in this talk. So this halted work on looking at statistical methods, this and some other things that happened having to do with government funding. So what did the field do? They said, let's forget this probabilistic stuff. And they moved to working on non-probabilistic models of language, such as if you've taken an introductory linguistics course, you've seen there. Okay. And a ton of progress was made there as well. All right, I want to make sure that's clear. This was fruitful in that we actually did make a lot of progress in understanding language from a non-probabilistic point of view. Okay. But then, you know, these stories always turn and twist. Okay, I already said that probabilistic models are behind things like Siri, things like Google Translate now. So how come they came back into favor? Okay. Well, in the 90s, some things changed. Huge amounts of data started coming online. You may or may not recognize that. That's the original Google logo from 1998, when that first thing first started. There started to be enough data online that you needed search engines to find all of it, right? At the same time, we had advances in computational techniques and in computational power. We could store large amounts of data from which to learn the probabilities of things, and we had the computational horsepower to implement the sort of sophisticated techniques we needed to overcome the Chomskyan objection. Okay. So in the 90s, it was actually termed the statistical revolution among my sort of cocktail party friends. You know, they came roaring back. In fact, things came back so much that inflammatory things got said. This was supposedly said by Fred Jelinek. There's a history behind this. But he said, every time I fire a linguist, my system's performance goes up. That is not a nice thing to say. But you see the kind of sentiment of the time. Where are we now? I'd like to argue that hopefully people stop saying things like, every time I fire one of your kind, I do better, and things like that. Right now, we do seem at a time where we are now trying to integrate the insights from language into these sophisticated statistical models that we have, and rainbows and unicorns and stuff. We have things like Siri, we have things like Watson, we're in a good spot right now, and I think the real interest is in doing this integration at this point. That's where we are now. I'd like to give an example to kind of exemplify what this kind of integration might look like. You'll have to bear with me a little bit. This is a slightly dated example, i.e. it's from March. You may or may not remember in March that there was some speculation whether Snooki from Jersey Shore was pregnant or not. In case you were wondering, yes, she was and still is, I believe. Okay. But so the speculation was rife. This was in the popular press. So you might have wondered in March 2012, is Snooki on Storkwatch? How do we ever try to answer these questions nowadays? So you try typing that into Google, Snooki on Storkwatch, okay, and what happened at that time is Google didn't know the answer. It came back with 8 results, only 8 at the time, and they're all from March 2011 and earlier, and therefore, given the normal duration of human pregnancies, not relevant at the time. Okay, but how might something like Watson figure out the answer to this, given the paucity of this data? Okay, well, and I've argued that we need a probabilistic approach, a data-driven approach, and something that incorporates linguistic insights. So let me try to give you a flavor for the kind of reasoning one can do. So we have our, again, question of earth-shattering importance to Snooki on Storkwatch, and we have a lot of data. Okay, we as human beings might note that this document here, this little snippet, actually answers the question, but remember, we're talking about a computer like Watson. It has no idea that expecting their first child together has anything to do with storks. Okay, so how might it make this inference that we are all able to do? Okay, well, it has access to many, many, many documents, lots of data. Data-driven approaches are kind of the key here. So in we might have other documents to look at, and you'll notice these ones mention on Storkwatch. They don't happen to mention Snooki. So your system might be able to reason, hey, in this document, I have the phrase, I have Bowie and Iman, I actually don't know how to pronounce her name, I'm sorry, on Storkwatch, and Bowie and Iman are expecting their first child. So there's a document out there that's making the connection, if only my system is sophisticated enough to recognize the patterns, that on Storkwatch has something to do with expecting a child. And in fact, because I have lots and lots and lots of data, I may as well check and make sure that this correlation is true. And in fact, here's another document which says Angie Harmon is on Storkwatch. Angie Harmon's expecting her first child. All right. So I have the data showing me these correlations between the idea of being on Storkwatch and expecting a child. Okay. Now I need some sophisticated language techniques to figure out that Angie Harmon is the person who is the law and order legal dish. So the linguistic analysis is coming in there too, and I do need to have sophisticated enough models that I don't make reasoning like this, that I see on Storkwatch and going from assistant direct district attorneying. Those aren't related, those aren't correlated, because if you know Snooki, this is kind of an unlikely thing for her to do. Okay, but this example was supposed to give you kind of the flavor of this kind of how can you look for patterns in the data and how can you use your language knowledge in order to make sense of some of these patterns, rule out some irrelevant patterns and things like that. Just an idea. The actual math is incredibly hairy. I will spare you it being after dinner. All right, so what has happened? What are the game changers? I would argue that they're data-driven approaches together with new insights about language. And, you know, in the question and answer period, I can tell you many, many more anecdotes about all these kind of things. I love this, but I don't have a ton of time here. Instead, I wanted to say one more little bit about what the future holds and what people are working on right now. So far, mostly talked about computers being able to understand what we say. Another set of aspect of those of us who are interested in language are interested in now is that we can use insights about language in order to get computers to understand more about us. Not just about what we say, but about human nature. Let me give you 2 examples I've been involved in. So you may recognize this. This is a scene from The Shining. What is this man saying? Oh, come on. Here's Johnny! A lot of people remember that, right? If he had said, hey, bunch of grapes, we probably wouldn't remember that, right? So is there something about what he said that causes us to remember this so that I can meet a whole bunch of strangers and we all recognize this communal moment of homicidal mania? All right. Well, You might say no. Does anyone know where Here's Johnny comes from? What, why it resonates? Johnny Carson used to say this, right? So you could say Ed McMahon. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm a little nervous. I'm kind of autopilot right now. Ed McMahon, that makes much more sense. Ed McMahon, say, here's Johnny. Johnny come. Check. Okay. Right. So maybe it's just a coincidence, okay, that here's Johnny stuck, because it happened to resonate with this cultural thing that was happening. But is there, and in that case, I think that's totally true. I don't think the phrase, here's Johnny, is so spectacularly interesting intrinsically. However, a group of my colleagues and I, Cornelians and ex-Cornelians, wanted to look at whether, beyond these situational effects, phrasing does affect memorability of quotes, say, of memes that travel through our culture, of sticky phrases like lipstick on a pig, things like that. Okay. So we were able to show that in aggregate, there are always individual counterexamples, big word warning there, but in aggregate, memorable movie quotes are unusual word choices built on a scaffolding of common part of speech patterns. Okay. And we were able to show this, and I won't get into the technical details, but we were able to show this with language models built probabilistically in some of the ways that I've hinted at before. Okay. And in fact, this insight carries over to ad slogans as well. I would argue that this makes sense. Something, in order to be memorable, for it to kind of stick in your mind, has to be a little different, or you just forget it. Okay. But it can't be so weird that you wouldn't remember it, that it would be very hard to reproduce. Okay. And this is the work that Bud was referring to. This, for better or for worse, got some attention in the media, and I guess this might be the highlight of my career, but we were made fun of by Kathy Lee Gifford on the Today Show because of this work. The idea that you could actually look at, say, movie quotes and figure out what language effects are there that are going to cause some of them to stick and some of them not to stick. That there is a language effect and that keeps some things propagating in our collective minds. Okay. Here's another example, again, looking at sort of subtle things you can pick up. There's a saying that Kate Niederhofer and James Pennebaker, esteemed psychologists at UT Austin, have said, that communicative behaviors are patterned and coordinated like a dance. When we interact, that there's this sort of coordination or accommodation that we make with each other. Okay. If you think about a dance, it becomes pretty obvious. If you look at these two people, you probably can figure out who has the lead. Okay, just through their patterns, who's following whom. Now here's a question. Can you infer this just from their language alone? And it turns out that you can. Here's the intuition. Suppose that every time Uma Thurman uses this pattern of a preposition and then an article, who is this again? John Travolta sort of echoes her. He doesn't use the exact phrases she uses. He doesn't say to the, but he says preposition, article. And then next time Uma Thurman says a preposition, he uses the same preposition. Next time she uses this preposition, then an article, he uses this, this doesn't have to be an exact thing, but in general, suppose it's the case that one person isn't just parroting back what someone else says, but they're mimicking the style unconsciously of what another person is saying. Then you might well assume that the person who's doing the mimicking is in somehow in a dependence relationship with the person who they are imitating. Okay. And we've run this both on some online data, and then kind of interestingly, recently we did it on Supreme Court. There are oral arguments in the Supreme Court, and you can actually see the judges, the lawyers, echoing in these very subtle functional word patterns what the judges are saying. Okay, so just from the language, we can pick up, with these very subtle language cues, we can see which people are deferring to or somehow dependent on others. Okay, so that's another case in which our language tells us something about who we are. All right, I'd like to conclude. This is my last slide. Why is this man smiling? So, Turing, remember? So, this smile, I want to say, it's not really a triumphant smile. It's sort of an enigmatic smile, right? He was looking ahead. He was hoping that in 50 years we would have systems that are able to pass the Turing test, able to communicate fluently with human beings. It hasn't come to pass yet. But we're kind of close. We should get there eventually. Back then, when he proposed this in, I think, 1950, he said, well, how are we going to accomplish this task? He said, "I do not know what the right answer is, but I think different approaches should be tried." A very mild-mannered thing to say. And then he concluded this essay, and this is the essay where he introduced the very notion of the Turing test with something sort of mild-mannered, but I've always found personally very striking. "We can only see a short distance ahead, but we can see plenty there that needs to be done." Those are his final words of that essay. These are my final words of the talk. Thank you. Through that how do I get to Boston dialogue, where clearly you had to know why the person was asking it, and you should understand why they didn't use a specific question is because there are these politeness norms in English. Okay, how much are people looking at this right now? The human-computer interaction folks are looking at it to some degree, precisely because they want conversations to seem fluent. It's hard because these sort of pragmatic things require sort of figuring out what does the person actually mean, what do they intend, what are they trying to get at, and similarly, what am I as the computer trying to do, what am I trying to accomplish, and we all know that these are hard questions, even human to human. There are sort of interesting things in speech that are easy to pick up. This isn't quite pragmatics, but for those of you who have dealt with phone menus, you know, you call up and it says press one. You've probably gotten irritated at some point, right? And everyone's like, please, why did you bring that up? You start showing signs of stress in what you say and how you say it. And there are actually people in speech recognition who are working on how do you recognize when someone's getting angry? And how do you recognize when they're going ballistic and kick them over to a human? Okay. So yes, people are working on this kind of thing. It's very hard. We can pick up kind of the easy parts, and sometimes they're proxies, like just this amount of stress that they're exhibiting in their speech. It's very important. It'll be a while before we really get there because of this notion of how do we know what people intend. Yes?
Since Homeland Security, there's been kind of a linguistic dragnet put over the internet for security purposes. I would think from your talk that huge amounts of problems with false accusations and things like that. You know, some of the catchword phrases that will alert them to some kind of problem. But how could they possibly get a context and find a perpetrator because of the sort of ambiguity and ceaselessness with people hang?
Can you repeat the question? Okay, I can repeat the question.
So, yeah.
So the question was I hadn't thought about this, so this is going to be an on-the-fly answer to the particular question that you're asking. Thinking about sort of surveillance and security applications, which, as you can imagine, are to some degree deployed. How, given the fact that language is hard to understand, do these systems sort of deal with false positives, if you will? How do we make sure that the interpretations that they're making are enough that, I guess, we can make a kind of, we can go for someone, so to speak? Is that?
Yeah, there's actually a program, I can't remember the name.
Okay, so I think I can't speak for what government officials are doing and the like, but it seems obvious that we would not rely only on automated analysis. if you're going to make an accusation or, God forbid, arrest someone, well, you know, depending on the situation, but if you're going to go forward in a legal sort of proceedings, you're going to, at the moment, you're going to have human confirmation of the system analyses. Given, I mean, this has actually been true before computers also, right? If you go to an airport, you are not supposed to joke about bombs, right? This is to prevent these sort of false positives. Yes, a black shirt.
Okay, so this isn't meant to be a leading question in any way because I'm a fan of technological progress. But so in this quote that Turing says, we may hope that machines will eventually compete with men in all purely intellectual fields. My question is, at the point that a machine can think at a higher level, abstractly, do more abstraction than a human can, does that not make humans obsolete in a sense? And so what is the point of progressing to that point?
So this Turing, okay, so the question is, isn't Turing saying the goal is to have machines match and presumably afterwards they will best us? Doesn't that sort of, what is the point of that in some sense? Does that pose a problem for us? I absolutely want to say that one should always try to think about the ethics of what one is doing. And I can't speak for everyone in the field. I know there are people who are very excited about the so-called singularity when human intelligence will be achieved by computers and things will happen. I think keeping in mind the engineering concerns does make sense here in that, first of all, the problems are so hard that trying to do research on, I'm going to make a computer that passes the Turing test, it's not enough of a direct goal that I think progress can really be actually made very quickly. Whereas saying, I just want machine translation to work better, that's something where I can think about where are the what are the errors it's making? Can I improve my model in such a way as to account for those kind of errors? I think if one keeps, putting my engineering hat on, I don't see an engineering application to making a computer as smart as a human. We have plenty of humans around, after all. I do see an application to creating better Google Translate, better translation systems, better summarization systems. In which case the concerns sort of are ameliorated in part because these things don't really act like people do, right? These kind of massive, a baby doesn't learn language by me giving it 10 years of the Wall Street Journal, going, read this and come back when you're five. Okay, woman behind him, yes.
So related to what you said previously about the telephone recognizing the tone of stress and how angry someone. Given that in language we can say the same thing, but by different inflection and intonation, we can mean something completely different. And then you can add on foreign speakers of a language, different accents, and or regional dialectal accents. How does that play into the understanding of commands from, I guess, like a programming standpoint?
Okay, so the question was, how about the, I basically concentrated on text here. What about sort of signals in speech, and even when you have non-native speakers, you have accents and things. Let me not deal with the non-native speaker thing just for a second. The speech signal can only help in roughly speaking. I can't quite say that, but in that information that we get about stress and tone and what's important in the sentence, if I say, show all flights on Tuesday, as opposed to show all flights on Tuesday, that kind of stress can often disambiguate the sentence for me. So in a rough sense, having the speech signal actually helps. On the other hand, having the speech signal can sometimes make things harder to recognize, right? If I say, show me all flights on Tuesday, right? And my model is built on standard English as opposed to whatever that was, Southwestern English or something like that, right? It can be harder for my system to understand that. So there are pluses and minuses. I don't have a technical judgment on whether it's better to work just on text or just on speech. Clearly, both of them, I sort of put them into the same thing. For non-native speakers of English, I think this is very important as these systems go global and as we have a more global kind of internet. The challenges are very interesting. You have to model things like accents. You have to model things like Russian speakers, for instance, tend to drop articles, things like that, making their sentences non-grammatical from an English point of view, but you still want to tell them when the flights are leaving, right? So these are all, I mean, there's the field is wide open in terms of having to deal with so many problems, but they're really fun problems, I would say.
So you've shown us that many systems use kind of a probabilistic approach to learn from the internet what a phrase is likely to be. I'm curious, is there a lot of work being done on using some sort of learning algorithm to learn how a speaker speaks or what he's likely to say during a conversation or over the course of a relationship with a speaker?
The question was, I guess I can phrase it as, are there systems out there to try to learn a specific person's sort of patterns of speech or what they're likely to say? And that's absolutely so. If you think even about, again, I keep using Google, I'm not, just because everyone's familiar with it. Google wants you to sign in nowadays, right? So it's tracking the queries you issue, and it is shaping what results it shows you based on the kind of things you tend to ask, as well as where you are and things like that. So absolutely, the notion of personalization is pretty hot right now. Systems are trying to use it. On the other hand, you don't want to over-personalize, because sometimes people actually think of something new to say. So there are these trade-offs. But it's something very much that current companies are thinking about. Yeah.
You know that nowadays, Siri and Google, they are trying to get information from their users, like their habits, or...
Yeah, as we just, yeah.
And do you think it's going to be a threat to our privacy in the future because they like keeping acting information?
So the question comes up very naturally related to the previous question. If these systems are collecting information about us, if they can figure out, you know, from our language use who we are getting along with, who aren't, you know, isn't this a threat to privacy? And the one word answer is yes. It's something we really have to think about. It would be it's very important, certainly for companies to make sure that users understand what they're signing up for, so to speak. And I don't think they're doing a great job at that now. That being said, there can be, you know, you as an individual or as a user may want to decide how much privacy do you want to give up for how much of a better experience are you going to have, assuming the experience gets better. These are extremely thorny issues. The most confident thing I can say is the one word answer, yes, there is issues of privacy. How we deal with this as individuals, as users of these systems, and how we deal with this as designers of these systems, and how we as society deal with this, these are really important questions, and I tend to think a lot about them. I don't have like a one answer, and I can't speak for any of these communities either. But it's very, very important that as these language technologies become more pervasive and personalized, that we think hard about what the implications are. Absolutely. Yeah.
How large is the field? How many professionals like you and others, and is it going up?
Thank you for calling me a professional. The question was, how big is the field? This is a little bit of a hard question to answer, but I was just at kind of the premier conference in the sort of text-based section of the field, and there are typically about 1,000 researchers who go there. Interest has really increased in these last data-driven years. So with the rise of Google and Microsoft doing Bing, to some extent Yahoo and things like that, now the Facebook, you know, they're... you know, people post things in natural language on Facebook, right? There's more and more demand coming on. I mean, if you count the speech people, that's another huge community. I don't have a really good number for you, but I do know that definitely in our undergrad curriculum, for instance, at Cornell and in the computer science department, interest has really picked up. It used to be when we would get applications for graduate school, no one would have a thought to do natural language processing because they never heard of it. Now we actually get quite a few people who are interested in doing it. The undergraduate class in natural language processing has about 150 people in it. So, and that's good. I'm happy. Now, if you also count people in linguistics and psychology and information science who are also interested in these things, in sort of computational approaches to language, that's going to broaden it even more. I think interest is very, very broad at the moment, in part because of the successes.
Natural language processing and computers help humans communicate better with each other.
This is something I'm super interested in. The question is, can these computational systems help humans communicate better with each other? An extremely glib answer is, of course, machine translation. At least this helps people who speak Russian talk to people who speak English, for instance, and they couldn't talk to each other before. That being said, something you hear a lot nowadays is about polarization, right? That the fact that all these people can now talk to each other on these internet forums and crazy things is causing people to become more extreme in their opinions, okay? And, or this whole notion of people are in their filter bubbles and, you know, they only talk to people who are like themselves. And this is an issue. This is an important issue. Let me see if I can come up with a kind of a coherent response to this. I think that one reason that I and my research group have been interested in these social aspects of language is precisely to try to see, can we pick up some kind of these subtle social cues that these people aren't getting along, or they're confused, or they're starting to be antagonistic. And you can, this is just talking off the top of my head, but you can imagine systems that suddenly, you know, on an online debate or something might say, whoa, you guys, you might want to consider cooling it down, it's looking a little hostile. You can imagine even more interventionist systems, although the problems with are you getting it right come in. So I think there's some potential. I'm really interested in systems that can kind of ease the social flow of things and recognize problems in that social flow in the language. Are we there yet? No, I think it's important. But things like machine translation are certainly helping more people talk to each other, or at least find out things that weren't accessible.
Part of the processing power and processing speed is probably going to continue to increase or improve at the same rate you've been improving. Is that going to make a big difference in the ability to do a better job with understanding or machines understanding language?
I think so. So the question is, with computational horsepower, so to speak, machines getting faster, storage getting cheaper, et cetera, are these going to help? In certain respects, absolutely. There's a saying in my field, more data is good data, or good data is more data. I'm not even sure it matters in some sense. You know, all these probabilistic models are looking for, you know, they are based on looking for patterns in data. The more representative the data, the better. And the faster and more powerful the machines, the more data we can handle. On the other hand, we have to be careful as a field to try to figure out where's the boundary between having more and being smarter. There's a kind of saying that some of the older people in my field say that is that people used to be better programmers back when they had to use paper tape. Because you had to be careful, right? Nowadays you just type in your program and the computer will just tell you, oh, you made a mistake. Whereas in the old days, you know, you had to punch these little holes and it took like 2 days for the thing to come back. And so people were actually sort of better programmers back then. So resource constraints tend to help the engineering sort of aspects of what people do. So in that sense, there's something to be said about it'd be nice if things maybe weren't growing as fast as they are. But on the other hand, again, it's an open question whether just having processors be faster and bigger and memory be bigger can be sort of being smarter. I think there's obviously room to explore in both. Redshirt. Can computers get jokes? There is a bunch. Well, can people get jokes? The question was, can computers get jokes? They sort of can. There are people who work on a sort of subfield called computational humor. Insofar as you can phrase jokes as something that is computationally tractable, then yeah, you can do it. So what are jokes? They're often things where something unexpected happens. You know, say when two concepts come together that you weren't necessarily expecting. And that's kind of what a lot of these things do, to kind of recognize things that might be jokes. Although sometimes they come out as word salad as well. In fact, there was a paper that got quite a bit of press at one of the big conferences last year. If people know the "that's what she said" kind of phrase, it's something, people say that's when she said, when someone just said something that turns out to have a salacious interpretation. Okay, so they... system that recognized situations in which you could say, that's what she said. So, to some extent, yes, this is possible, and we can talk about more offline. All right, one final question.
Are all human languages equally difficult or easy to program for, or some more attack than others?
So the question is, are all human languages, you know, across the variety of them, equally easy to process, shall we say? There are a couple of ways to answer that. One is whether they're inherently, never mind the processing stuff, whether there are some languages that are somehow inherently more complicated than others. I don't actually understand the state of current thinking on that. I don't really know. I do know that they're kind of funny, just to throw out a little cocktail party anecdote. There are little graphs you can find on the web of when English speakers say something's incomprehensible, they say, it's all Greek to me. What do the Greeks say? What do the Chinese say? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out there are interesting regularities in what given languages say are more complicated other languages. I think Chinese tends to be the kind of writ, if you will, for a lot of them, things like that. But I don't actually know. I know there have been various studies trying to show whether some languages have higher information content than others, kind of per character, per word. I honestly don't know what the setting is. For the computational aspect, obviously that uncertainty relates, but there's a more concrete answer I can give you, which is simply, if more data is good data, then languages you have more data for are going to be easier to do. English, there's a lot of stuff available, so there are very high quality systems and subsystems for English. For lesser used languages, there's less of that data, so they tend to be poorer. The stuff tends to be of sort of poorer quality. I wish I could end on a more up note than that. At least there's good stuff for English. Thank you very much for coming.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.